Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
It being so close to home with 3 people involved, and it's hard, you know, we know that someone's loved one out there.
After more than a week, the search continues for a missing group of moose hunters near Bethel. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, September 9th. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, a court ruling allows Metlakatla tribal members to fish outside reservation boundaries.
We're excited, grateful that the Ninth Circuit confirmed our fishing rights.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Invasive plants and animals threaten Alaska's environment and economy and can spread to new locations by hitching a ride. Anyone can help prevent the spread of invasive species by remembering to play clean go, removing all plants, animals, and mud from boots, gear, and vehicles before entering and leaving recreational areas will help stop invasive species in their tracks. Learn more at playcleango.org. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
26 Alaska places on federal land now have new names to remove a derogatory word for Native women. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland's order changing hundreds of names across the U.S. containing the slur went into effect yesterday. Haaland is the first Native American cabinet secretary, and she says she felt a deep obligation to ensure federal lands and waters are welcoming. She says, quote, "That starts with removing racist and derogatory names that have graced federal locations for far too long," unquote. The renamed Alaska places are mainly waterways, about half of them in the Yukon-Koyukuk census area, with others in interior and southeast Alaska and the Mat-Su. 9 of the new names are indigenous. Meanwhile, a federal appeals court has ruled that Metlakatla tribal members shouldn't need state permits to fish in waters they've traditionally relied on, even outside their reservation's boundaries. As KRBD's Eric Stone reports, the decision is a significant victory in the tribe's decades-long fight for fishing rights.
The Ninth Circuit's 28-page opinion is broad and unambiguous. The 1891 law that created Metlakatla's reservation gives tribal members the right to fish in areas near Ketchikan and Prince of Wales Island, outside the boundaries of the Annette Island Reserve. Metlakatla Mayor Albert Smith says it's a significant win in a decades-long fight for tribal sovereignty.
We're still going over it, but we're excited, grateful that the Ninth Circuit confirmed our fishing rights.
The ancestors of Metlakatla Tsimshian people relocated from their former home in British Columbia in the late 19th century at the invitation of the U.S. government. In 1891, Congress passed a 101-word statute creating the Annette Islands Reserve, quote, "for the use of the Metlakatla Indians." Now, that law does not specifically mention fishing rights, but the tribe argued in its 2020 lawsuit that Congress intended the Annette Islands to be a permanent, self-sustaining home for the tribe, and that that wasn't possible without the ability to fish outside the reservation's marine boundaries. They pointed to past court precedents and 19th century historical records of Metlakatla residents fishing in places like Naha Bay near Ketchikan and Carta Bay on Prince of Wales Island. U.S. District Court Judge John Sedwick sided with the state of Alaska and dismissed the case in February of last year, saying the 1891 law and the historical record didn't imply that Congress granted the tribe off-reservation fishing rights. But the Ninth Circuit disagreed, as Metlakatla's attorney Christopher Lundberg explains.
The key question that the Ninth Circuit resolved in Metlakatla's favor was whether Congress in 1891 granted, when they established a reservation, also granted the community the right to fish on a non-exclusive basis in waters outside the reservation.
The appeals court sent the case back to the district court for further consideration, but Lundberg says the major legal question has been resolved. Alaska Department of Law Communications Director Patty Sullivan, though, called the decision perplexing and disappointing in a written statement. She said the court went out of its way to decide issues that were not before it, misconstrued facts, and misapplied the law. She also said the decision upends the state's efforts to manage its fisheries in line with the state constitution. She said the state is considering whether to appeal the case. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Eric Stone.
Bethel Search and Rescue continues to search for a group of moose hunters missing for a week and a half near Bethel and another hunter missing for over a week near Kalskag. KYUK's Will McCarthy joined the volunteers to search for the missing hunters near Bethel and has this report.
It's day 8 of the search. After a morning briefing, about a dozen volunteers head toward their boats. It's raining, as it has been for much of the search since three moose hunters, Justin Crow, Shane McIntyre, and Carl Flynn, went missing. Mike Riley, the longtime president of Bethel Search and Rescue, drives towards the harbor. Here's Mike.
It being so close to home with three people involved, and it's hard, you know, we know that someone's loved one out there. People depend on you to look for them and find them and bring them home for closure.
At the harbor, Mike checks his gear. Bethel Search and Rescue is working off the assumption that the boat sank in rough waters after the men dropped off equipment at their hunting camp upriver. They're also dragging the bottom of the river with weighted hooks to try to locate the boat. The fact that they haven't found it makes the search unusual. At 18 feet long, it should be hard to miss. Also unusual is that three people went missing at the same time, and then another person, further upriver, near Kalskag. Search and rescue is not easy work. Searchers are out in all conditions, often for 10 or 12 hours a day. After 30 years volunteering, Mike noted that he wasn't a young man anymore. He leaves the harbor and heads towards Strait Slough, where the six boats are searching for the missing hunters. Before he left, Mike got some information that he thinks could help narrow their search area.
Eric, I'm sorry it took so long to come out here, but I was told something that I think it would enlighten us.
Mike says he got a tip that two people were coming home to Bethel the day after the hunters were reported missing. They saw an aluminum pole bobbing straight upright in the water about 20 feet from shore, just a few hundred yards upriver of Strait Slough. They had to swerve to avoid it. Mike thinks it could be a clue.
That's on that side of the river. That side really never really been dropped.
After hours of scanning sonar and dragging lines, hoping to catch something, even just this little piece of information feels like a burst of energy. Hope, Mike says, is the name of the game.
You guys, he's going to go up on that side, and if you guys can drag about 20 feet out, go ahead.
Okay.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you.
Searching the river is a test of endurance. A few of the boats scan the search area with sonar, slowly making a grid of each section of the river. The rest use drag bars, which are long ropes attached to a metal bar. Each of the lines have a weighted hook at the end. The idea is, if there's something underwater, the hooks will catch on. Mike drags the bottom of a 100-yard portion of the river. The tide is slack, so he keeps one hand on the rope and the other on the steering wheel. Nothing. He tries again. Nothing. It starts to rain. Mike tries again.
Majority of the people that was out here are still out here from day one, and it's a lot of stress and frustration. You know, we're working in the dark.
So far, the main clues they have is debris from the missing boat that turned up near the head of Strait Slough. But there's still so much river to cover. Still, Bethel Search and Rescue has never given up on a search. There's no plans for this to be the one where they do.
That was the question, how long are you going to search? As long as somebody's willing to come out here, we're going to continue.
Mike said they're always looking for volunteers. Some people who took vacation time to be part of the search will have to return to work soon. On Strait Slough, upriver of Bethel, I'm Will McCarthy.
Anchorage Mayor Dave Bronson plans on closing a campground that's become a makeshift homeless camp at the end of the month. Since late June, after the Sullivan Arena mass shelter was closed, homeless residents have slept in tents and cars at the Centennial Park campground in northeast Anchorage. The Bronson administration bused people to the campsite from Sullivan and waived camping fees. In an email, Bronson spokesman Corey Allen Young says Centennial will be closed to the public on September 30th. He says transportation will be provided to bring homeless campers to either the Spinard or Fairview Rec Centers, which officials announced would be converted into emergency shelters starting September 29th. Other aspects of the mayor's emergency shelter plan include using 20 portable buildings provided for free by an unnamed community partner and extending sheltering options at the Aviator Hotel, plus housing people at the new shelter and navigation center being built in East Anchorage. Young says the mayor's intent is to begin phasing out use of the rec centers as the other shelter options become available. The mayor is set to ask the assembly to amend city code to allow use of the portable buildings during the next assembly meeting on September 13th. Young says the city aims to reopen Centennial to general camping in the spring. Coming up on Alaska News Nightly, Master Carvers and their apprentices create Juno's Totem Pole Trail.
lot of times there's a lot of back and forth between the artist, the carvers, and the oral historians or caretakers of the culture.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you are a hunter, birder, or outdoor enthusiast, the U.S. Geological Survey is asking for help tracking the bird populations in Alaska. The USGS manages a nationwide bird banding program, and every year, thousands of birds are marked with small, numbered leg bands. If you see, find, or harvest a banded bird, please report the band number online at reportband.gov. The information provided will help inform how bird populations may be changing. This message sponsored by the USGS Alaska Science Center.
Biologists say they're picking up the pace on genetics research to better understand the issue of salmon bycatch, and they hope their findings could be useful to managers making policy decisions about fishing in Alaska's federal waters. KDLL's Sabine Pooks has more.
Salmon stocks from up and down the Pacific coast congregate in the Gulf of Alaska and in the Bering Sea to feed. And that's also where trawlers go to harvest millions of pounds of pollock and other groundfish. And those trawlers often accidentally scoop up salmon and other fish in their nets too, a problem known as bycatch. Scientists with NOAA Fisheries want to trace where the bycatch is coming from so they can also understand the impacts of bycatch on specific stocks. That's especially true for salmon stocks in western Alaska, an area of the state that's seeing dismal salmon returns.
100% that's our focus for chum, given its overweighted importance to subsistence fisheries.
Wes Larson is a geneticist with NOAA Fisheries. His team analyzes and sequences the DNA of salmon samples coming off trawler vessels to estimate what portion of the salmon bycatch is coming from where. Geneticists have been using that technology for years. But now Larson says advancements are helping them do that analysis much quicker, which in turn could inform more up-to-date decisions from fisheries managers. Data from NOAA is an important source of information for the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, which manages fishing in Alaska's federal waters. And many of the trawl vessels that scoop up the most bycatch in Alaska are operating in those areas.
The narrative changes so much depending on if you have the genetic data or not, especially for the chum salmon.
The bycatch issue has generated a lot of concern in Alaska, particularly for the small boat fishermen who are impacted by decreased salmon stocks. Last year, the Federal Council took action on halibut bycatch in the Bering Sea, imposing limits on some trawl fleets based on halibut stock abundance. But it passed up a chance to place new rules on trawlers that catch salmon bycatch this summer, instead requesting new analysis from researchers. King salmon stocks are declining sharply across Alaska, as are chum salmon in western Alaska in particular, where the species is an important source of food for subsistence fishermen and their families.
If we use all of our data to understand where western Alaska stocks are, then we can help direct the fleet away from those stocks.
Previously, the program's taken as long as a year and a half to get genetic results back to biologists. Larson says today his team's using updated technology and automated tools to get that information into managers' hands much faster. Still, he says the answer's not as simple as telling one fleet to stop fishing at one time.
There's no easy solution. It's this really complicated problem of like fleet dynamics and like different boat types and their ability to move. And so there are definitely, you know, options, and that's what we're trying to do. But the question is, unfortunately, really complicated, which is why we're throwing so much data at it, I guess.
There are other factors at play in salmon declines as well. Scientists think one big culprit in some of those population changes is climate change. That was likely the biggest reason for the recent drastic drop in Pacific cod stocks, another species that Larson's team is monitoring. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
A new exhibit of Northwest Coast art is coming to Juneau's waterfront. Sea Alaska Heritage Institute invited master carvers and their apprentices in Southeast to create 10 totem poles representing Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian cultures. They'll be part of the Institute's totem pole trail, which will ultimately include 30 poles, and be installed in Juneau sometime next year. KRBD's Reagan Miller spoke with carvers from throughout Southeast about their work on the project.
The Sea Alaska Heritage Institute sees Juneau as the Northwest Coast art capital of the world. They hope the Totem Pole Trail will help visitors see it the same way. Sea Alaska's long-term goal is for invited carvers to make 30 poles that will adorn Juneau's waterfront. All the carvers will be working with apprentices as part of an effort to create the next generation of Northwest Coast artists. Metlakatla's David R. Boxley is one of the carvers. He says he's excited that traditional carvings will be among the first things Tura see after stepping off a cruise ship.
I think it's easy for people to forget, and too often Indigenous folks are thought of, for the lack of a better word, and the word that a lot of Westerners use is primitive. We were not. The Northwest Coast was a thriving, ancient civilization.
The Metlakatla carver is creating a pole representing the Tsimshian people. He started carving at the age of 6, guided by his father, David A. Boxley. Since then, he's finished more than 25 poles. Boxley's pole for Juno will feature the crests of the eagle, raven, wolf, and killer whale moieties. Kluwak teacher John Rowan also is carving for the trail. He credits his father and many Prince of Wales Island teachers with sparking his love for the craft.
It's a pole for the Ishkahitan people. They're out of the Taku River, and it's a raven, frog, and sea lion on the that's being represented on that one.
And Heidelberg's T.J. Young is working on two poles. One will feature a Haida raven crest, and the other, a Tlingit raven crest.
So I'm doing raven crest on the Tlingit pole, and I'm doing raven crest on a Haida totem pole. And I'm Haida myself, so I'm going to be, and that was kind of a traditional thing. You do the opposite. You do the opposite of your clan. You carve the opposite. Eagle would never carve eagles. Ravens would never carve ravens.
Young says he takes a lot of inspiration from his grandfather, whose generation was discouraged from sharing traditional knowledge. He feels lucky he was able to learn.
And it was literally outlawed, the potlatch and the culture and the language. So but they knew that they had to, they had to adapt, they had to change without changing, if that makes any sense.
He says it made his grandfather proud to watch him and his brother carve. In Saxman, renowned Tlingit carver Nathan Jackson and his son Stephen Jackson are both at work on their own poles. They're working with 4 apprentices. Stephen Jackson uses the artist name Jackson Paulus. His pole represents the Shongukedi clan.
The story is kind of given to the carvers, and in some cases it's more set, but a lot of times there's a lot of back and forth between the artist, the carvers, and the oral historians or caretakers of the culture to ensure that that is a piece of art ultimately that is respectful of both those aspirations.
His father's pole honors the Wushkatan clan. The first figure on the pole is an eagle, and the second, a mountain. He says he wasn't quite sure at first why the mountain was to be on the pole, but he learned that the clan would put a pole in the ground over a cache of frozen meat.
They actually did a totem pole and put it right there to lay claim to that place.
In Sitka, Tommy Joseph and Nicholas Gallinan are each working on separate poles. When Joseph was invited to the project by Sea Alaska Heritage Institute president Rosita Worrell, he got to work sketching out an idea.
Yeah, I'd given them, like, I think overall 4 different renditions because I had it way too complicated at first and need to loosen up a bit and reduce some of it. And so we did that a few times. And after the 4th rendition, they agreed on it. And so made them their model.
Gallinan's pole represents the Kaguantan clan. He says the Totem Pole Trail project has spurred a carving boom. He says there's likely more carving going on now in Southeast than there's been in 40 years. He says he hopes the project ensures that traditional art endures for generations to come.
I think it's going to be really important to all of these communities. I think it'll be amazing for these artists that are apprenticing and getting to work on the project. Hopefully, you know, in the continuum of this type of work.
Gallinan's working with 2 apprentices, his cousin, Lee Burkhart, and a longtime mentor, Will Burkhart. All 10 poles should be finished by December. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing cargo transportation to 9 Alaska communities. NAC offers options including cargo charters to get freight where it needs to be. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Everyone knows eating fruits and veggies promotes a long and healthy life. It's important to make every bite count. Alaskans are lucky to have greens and berries from the land, as well as fresh, frozen, and canned. When it comes to living a long and healthy life, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by USDA SNAP Ed.
We When Sitkins learned they would be seeing a record-breaking number of cruise passengers this summer, there were a lot of questions about how the town would accommodate the influx of people from traffic flow to garbage. Swilling in the middle of all of those concerns were public toilets. Sitka had nowhere near enough. So the city had to scramble and find solutions, and that meant acquiring some high-end toilet trailers and offering a unique grant program. KCAW's Catherine Rose has the scoop.
When I found out the city was going to install several temporary bathrooms on Lincoln Street, I had to sniff out the situation myself. So one day this summer, I visited the big white trailer parked in front of the Pioneer Home.
Well, I don't know what I expected, but I did not expect this.
The women's bathroom has a sunroof with natural light filtering in. There's a big mirror next to the door with not one, but two sinks. The toilets are low flow and surprisingly quiet.
I'm just going to go ahead and flush.
This unit is one of three that's been installed on Lincoln Street to accommodate what was originally predicted to be the biggest cruise year in Sitka's history. Amy Ainsley is the city's planning director.
They seem really sanitary. They're, you know, kind of keeping the unpleasant parts of temporary bathrooms contained.
The big white trailers are hard to miss right on the downtown thoroughfare. That's because getting them shipped here took some flying by the seat of your toilet.
They came a little bit later in the season than we were hoping for, but, you know, I'll sing the same song that every industry, everyone has sung about supply chain. You know, we're all dealing with those same issues.
The units finally arrived in June. Initially, the city looked at installing them on private property where they could be attached to the city's sewer system. But Ainsley says they needed to install them fast. So placing the units on Lincoln Street without hard plumbing them was the simplest option. They've gotten a bit of feedback about the bathrooms from Sitkins, and she's hoping for more in the coming weeks. So far, comments have run the gamut from folks suggesting new locations or ways to make the trailers more aesthetically pleasing to requests for public access after cruising hours. That last one presents a complication. All of the staff cleaning the bathrooms are paid with cruise passenger excise tax money. That's Sitka's share of the state head tax on every passenger who arrives in Alaska on a cruise ship. But that money is very restricted. It can only go toward things that directly benefit the passengers. But the trailers aren't the only bathrooms newly open to the public, at least for the next month or so.
There are a lot of tourists in town this summer, and we don't mind people coming in.
Joel Hansen directs Southeast Alaska Independent Living. Sale is one of six businesses that participated in the city's bathroom grant program that paid downtown businesses $1,000 if they opened their hearts and their toilets to tourists this summer. Sale's building is a little way from downtown, but tourists do pass by often.
My thought was that a lot of folks would be accessing our trails in Sitka and kind of spreading out from the downtown corridor a little bit.
So Hansen filled out the application, they got the cash, and their business was listed on a map provided to tourists by Visit Sitka. Hansen says they haven't seen a lot of traffic, even during the busiest part of the season, but he's happy to provide both of Sale's bathrooms as a community service, open to everyone. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Catherine Rose.
Anyone acquainted with the beauty industry knows there's a myriad of odd, sometimes extreme ingredients, from snail slime to gold leaf, that are said to do wonders for the skin. But in Sitka, one woman is going back to the basics, harnessing the power of her barnyard pets to make luxury soap. KCAW's Tash Kimmel has more.
It's a cool summer morning on Edelin Street, and like most days, I've come to milk two of Sitka's resident goats, Sunny and Tanya.
Ladies.
Goats aren't all too common in Southeast Alaska. In fact, there's only one USDA-certified goat dairy in the entire state. But this milk isn't going to be made into cheese or put on cereal. Soon, it'll be a bar of soap.
I don't have any soaps that don't use goat milk.
That's Evening Star Gruder, founder of Evening Star Soaps and Salves. The Sitka-based business sells an array of handcrafted goods, but Eve Gruder's artisanal goat milk soap is the real star of the show.
Goat milk adds to the soap lather and some soothing properties for the skin and whatnot.
You wouldn't know it now, but it was only a year ago that Gruder sold her first bar of soap. Like many businesses created in the height of the pandemic, Evening Star Soaps and Salves was born out of necessity. Having left commercial fishing as a newly single mom, Gruter needed a new plan.
Maybe COVID is part of why it happens, because I couldn't go out and get a different job. And I really, really needed something that I could do and be a stay-at-home mom.
The idea came to her after a friend offered to give her free life coaching sessions.
We brainstormed a bunch of different things I could do for income. I went and chose soap to learn about soap and to go into making soap, because everybody washes. And it was a rather humble start with that thought, and now it's turned into like a luxury soap.
When I meet Gruter, she's in her basement, which doubles as a kind of soap laboratory.
Part of my basement is now child play area, and the rest of it's rapidly being taken over by soap making, soap curing, soap packaging, soap everywhere. It's turned into a little micro soap factory.
What kind of soap are you making right now?
This is dandelion, lemon, clove. Them out later.
The soap making process is long and at times scientific.
It's chemistry. You've got your base and your acid, and you add the base to the acid, and the result makes a crystal, which is soap. Soap is a crystalline structure, and the goat milk and water are necessary to dissolve the base so that it can react with the oil.
Gruter measures out coconut oil and mango butter with precision, adding to the perfume of essential oils already permeating the room.
Hard oils and get them melting. So I'm going to take a little bit of the mango butter and put it for the super fat oil at the end.
Once all the elements are melted and mixed, she pours the sweet-smelling concoction into molds and lets it cure for 6 weeks. Gruter sells her soaps locally and online. Her bars are on bathroom sinks and kitchen counters as far as Japan. But while Gruter's soap has evolved to include an array of specialty butters and oils, many of her first products were inspired by the medicinal plants of Alaska.
I harvested some Devil's Club and infused some oils and made some soap, and it smelled like Devil's Club, and I was really happy with that. And then the neighbors cut down a spruce tree, and I thought, you know, that spruce smells really nice. I'm going to go try some spruce needles. Spruce is like a northern worldwide medicinal plant.
For now, Gruter's hopes are humble. While she's fishing again from time to time, Gruter comes clean and admits that she's gone too far into soap to ever want to slip back. Tanya, no. Tanya. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Tosh Kimmel.
Hey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Chris Clint in Anchorage, Will McCarthy in Bethel, Catherine Rose and Tash Kimmel in Sitka, Eric Stone and Reagan Miller in Ketchikan, and Sabine Pooks in Kenai. Our audio engineer is Dave Emmert, Katie Anastas is our producer, and we're going to miss Eric Bork so much. I'm Wesley Early. Have a great weekend.
NEA Alaska is a professional education association representing over 11,000 of Alaska's dedicated public school employees. Their members are united in their commitment to provide an excellent education for every student, regardless of background or zip code. Together, NEA Alaska members work with colleagues, parents, and their communities to build strong public schools that are productive, safe, and welcoming to all. Learn more at neaalaska.org. This message sponsored by NEA Alaska.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.